issue of U.S. foreign policy and the strategy of warfare called low-intensity conflict, which should be clear by now. I always think that when we say that term, we should put it in quotations, because the pain that it causes is not at all low intensity. And just to review a little bit, this session is going to focus on the whole issue of democracy. And certainly one of the things that we read and hear in almost every presidential speech, congressional debate, is that the U.S. is promoting democracy in El Salvador, democracy in Central America, or that we're concerned about democracy all over the world. And this session is meant to challenge that view. The previous sessions, how many of you have not been at any of the other sessions? Okay, a couple. So just a very quick review. In the first session, I looked a little bit at how the inequalities between countries in the North and the third world or two-thirds world, how those conflicts were very real, that from the perspective of the poor, fundamental social change is essential to their possibility of living a decent life, and how the United States has from very early on defined its foreign policy, the goal of its foreign policy, is to maintain the disparity between the rich and the poor. And I used a couple of quotes from U.S. leaders. And how increasingly the enemies of the United States are being defined as the organized poor in third world settings. And that was true even before the thaw in East-West relations. In the second session, we dealt with the worldview and strategy, and I talked a lot about the U.S. capacity for intervening in third world settings, spoke about El Salvador and Nicaragua, talked about El Salvador as a fairly classic case of counterinsurgency in which the United States is backing a government that is at war against its own people, equipping that government, training the government. I talked about Nicaragua as a classic example of something called pro-insurgency, where the United States, when there is a government that it doesn't like, that it in fact creates insurgencies, creates people to wage war against that country and divert its attention from development to warfare. How victory's been redefined within the framework of low-intensity conflict to mean you not only defeat your enemy and then put a government in place that you like, that might be victory, but if you can't do that, then you simply destroy an option that you don't like. And that the Contras were trained in tactics to simply destroy a country, that was their purpose. I talked about the management of terrorism in places like El Salvador, of how terrorism is linked to specific political objectives, of as popular movements begin to build and clamor for change, the repression escalates. When those movements are decapitated and slowed down, then the repression becomes more selective. And then as they build again, is what is the case in El Salvador, then the repression intensifies dramatically. In yesterday's session, I talked about why U.S.-backed governments kill priests and gave examples of the ideology of a national security state in which essentially the military sees itself as the defender of the elite capitalist class, which they see as the key group to being able to create a society of freedom and with ample goods, and how the United States has fed that ideology, and how the church, particularly the church that seeks liberation of the poor, has been defined as enemy. Okay, that's a very, very sketchy summary of some of the issues. To get started today, I wanted to again give you about 10 minutes, begin in 10 minutes in small groups, and it doesn't matter whether you've been here before or not. I'm going to lift up three questions and have you deal with them briefly. And the first question will be dependent upon whether you have been here or not, at least at one other session. First question is, what concerns do you have about our democracy and U.S. support for democracy, in quotes, in places like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and elsewhere? Or concerns about our own democracy? And again, that for many of you, that question would make sense in the context of what I've shared over the earlier three sessions. For those of you who weren't here, you don't have to answer that one. But you may have concerns too, and you can. Second one, all anybody can answer, and that is, what did we learn from the Iran-Contra affair? What happened in the Iran-Contra affair? And just try to remember with each other. What did we learn? And I'm going to talk a little bit about some things that we probably didn't learn from the Iran-Contra affair. And then third, what is it that you most value about democracy? Because I would guess for most of us in this room, democracy is something that's pretty important. And that's one of the things that makes me really concerned about this strategy of warfare, is because I do think democracy is important. So let's try to identify that which is most important to us about democracy. So take about 10 minutes, and then I'll call us back, and we'll report back in a similar kind of brainstorm format that we've been using. So groups of three or four. Don't get any larger than that, because then people don't have an opportunity to speak.
Yeah. Brother, it's a great
got two more minutes. Come into sessions like this with three or four questions, give them to you, and then leave. Because it's really an awful feeling to cut off conversations. But in the interest of time, again, I would like to get us back together, and let's begin in the kind of brainstorm format, just throwing out. Let's deal with the first question first. What are some of the concerns that you have about our democracy and about U.S. sponsored democracy overseas in light of some of the issues that we've been talking about?
I think my biggest concern is that if we truly have a democracy and if we are supporting, if we have a democracy, then we're not supporting a democracy in El Salvador, Nicaragua, or anywhere else, because democracy to me means voice of the people. And voice of all the people, or at least all the people who are willing to be involved in that voice. And the U.S. is supporting a government. It's supporting the rich, the oligarchy, the people who are on top, and it doesn't give any of the poor people or any of the people below a middle class sort of setting any voice in government. So I think that it's different between our democracy and what their democracy is. I don't think we can have another democracy.
So it's highly questionable the natures of the democracies that we're supporting.
That we can support.
Let me just ask you a question, given what you said. Do you think that that our democracy is fundamentally different than El Salvador's in terms of do we have, are poor represented? I mean, I just raised the question.
I think that we had a lot more resources to give away initially, and that's what actually made this democracy what it is, that we had enough resources that even the rich could get enough and the poor people could have something.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so that's what makes it work. I don't think that our poor people have any more of a voice, but if they wanted to, they could. You know, that's the only thing that...
Other comments? What other concerns came up?
If we quit giving so much money to the government and the military, the world would be better off.
Amen.
Here, here.
To argue.
Yes.
I had one kind of idea that drew all the questions together, which was my biggest concern, I guess, about democracy would be the fact that there would be elements in our government who truly don't care what people want and are just going to do what they please, regardless of that. But that is kind of how questions 2 and 3 came into it, and what the Iran-Contra affair meant to me is that our country is actually maybe naive and idealistic enough to that when these people are caught, then we're going to bring them out and we're going to say these people are felons because they did go against the will of the people and the law of the land. And we're actually, I mean, what other country would throw such a fit over something I have always assumed happens every day, which I always assumed that there were elements in the government, you know, I always assumed that CIA is torturing people. And yet, when these people are caught, we do make a big deal about it. And maybe that's one of the things I value about our country, is that we actually do try to be idealistic. And when we find these things, we try and stop them.
So you think that we did try to get at who was behind Iran-Contra, and we did punish those people?
No.
Is that what you're saying?
No.
There are a lot of people in the United States who were very deeply upset over the fact that we discovered
that we're not
following the will of the government. And maybe the correct, I'm quite sure that there were a lot of elements of the government that were not punished as they should have been. But nevertheless, at least...
The issue came up,
and there were a lot of people who cared about it, and I'm glad that at least could happen.
Okay, good. Go ahead, Tracy.
Well, we were talking about that in our group. And it was a little bit different from that. The thing that we learned from the Iran-Contra affair was that people don't really care that much. That was kind of what we thought, was that they care enough to make a show of something bad happened, we're going to talk about it in a little while, so people will then sit back and watch the next show that comes on TV. But we were concerned that... that what we learned was that people didn't, when they learned this was happening, stand up and cry out for some kind of justice and some kind of turnaround. Nothing changed. You know, now Ollie North is out giving speeches in colleges and making lots of money.
$25,000
a time. What kind of punishment is that for someone who broke the law of the land? It's not. The man is doing really well. And so, and no one seems to stand up and say, wait a minute, this is wrong. People are just, you know, sitting back and going on with their lives. So I think it just placated us.
The term that a lot of people use to describe the Iran-Contra hearings is damage control. Mm-hmm. That something happened that couldn't be ignored, and so you had to do something. But the challenge was to do something without getting to the substance of what the issues
right.
were. That would be a definition of damage control. I'll come back to that and suggest that while I think it's right, it's good that issue came up, and there are some countries that it just would be totally hidden under the table. Most of the substance got hidden under the table, and that's what scares me.
I think it's almost more dangerous when it does come up a little bit and then goes away than it is when
because
everybody
knows.
Because
it makes us feel that we are different.
Right. It makes us feel like, oh, we're doing fine, we're democratic, we can go on with our lives. And that's almost more dangerous.
The
other thing that makes me fearful about the Iran-Contra affair is for what I've heard and read and understand is that the characters, the players involved in it and involved in this damage control have been there since the Vietnam era, and they're still there.
So there's a long history of involvement by many of the same actors whose names surfaced in the Iran-Contra affair have been with us in clandestine activities for the past 25 years, some of them. I'll come back to that too. What did we learn from Iran-Contra, or what issues were raised, or what other concerns do we have about our democracy?
The big concern that I had was kind of shared with, that goes along with this, is the misinformation or false information mm-hmm. that we're being given. The fact that even when someone is interested enough to be informed, that they're being misinformed, and it's hard to be informed. accurately, thank you.
Good. So the whole issue of information. Seems to me information is really central to a democracy. And one of the things that I would say is that we have access in this country to a tremendous amount of information. I think we can find out what's going on in the world if we want to. I don't think we can find out what's going on in the world or what our country is doing if we rely upon the major media channels for that information, which is true, which is what 90% of the people who bother to pay attention to the news, where they get their information.
And that's part of the reason why I have a hard time with this word democracy, because I really don't believe we live in a democracy.
No, we don't.
At best, we live in something that resembles a republic, where we elect a lot of white men to go to Washington and do whatever the hell they want to based on whatever corporations are going to get them the right votes so they can win. That's not democratic to me, nor is the media's influence, which you talk about, and the fact that it's so hard to find alternative resources, or there's something, there's a force out there that doesn't want us to get a complete story. And then to expand that further, I don't call it this is democracy when you've got CIA people and FBI people everywhere getting files on everyone who's taking part in any kind of peace demonstration, and then they act with complete impunity throughout the world. It's really terrifying when you think about it.
Okay, let's take one more. And anybody who hasn't had a chance to say anything yet wants to? Yeah.
I think one of the things that I learned from the Iran-Contra deal, in terms of lifestyle, and lifestyle we have in this country, is the fact that it was such a TV show. I mean, you turned it on like you turn on Twin Peaks and Dynasty and Dallas. it's real life, and yet it's not. I mean, people felt like they were involved and said, I was involved because I watched it every day. And yet we're as interested or uninterested as they are in what happens on the next episode of Dallas. I think it's a statement about our lifestyle and about how TV is kind of the god. And we, you know, we kind of turn it on and say, yeah, I'm really involved because I'm sitting here watching it. And you turn it off and then going on with what I would have done had I not watched it.
It's an interesting observation how it's almost like the TV world and our world become blurred and both lose meaning or both become almost meaningless.
It almost ends up with a myth of involvement then too.
Well, this is the hardest of the presentations for me to organize in a intelligent way, so I hope you'll bear with me. But I just want to share a few observations about this question about democracy. And then we'll open it up for more questions and conversation. And I wanted to start out by saying a couple things. I think that there is a myth that binds most U.S. people together. Probably several myths. But one of them, and the strongest one, is the myth of the benevolent superpower. And the myth of the benevolent superpower says that we're different. That the United States isn't like other empires. We weren't like Britain, and we're not like the Soviet Union. We're a benevolent superpower, and we're out there fighting for freedom, etc. And what I've tried to do in this book, War Against the Poor, is I've tried to let, to some degree, our government leaders speak for themselves. And they occasionally do it openly and honestly. And one of the quotes I used was the quote from Keenan in 48. Earlier about, he was saying, the world is an incredibly divided place in which we have most of the wealth and most other people are poor, and our task is to create a system that preserves that disparity. And if we're going to do that, we can't even talk about democracy, we can't talk about human rights, we've got to be engaged in power politics. Another quote that I would like to share with you along the same vein is that shortly after United States created the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Council, it commissioned a study that former President Hoover, who was known as the Hoover Report, basically on what the United States had to do in the world to maintain its privileges. And just quoting one paragraph from that, it says, It's now clear that we, the United States, are facing an implacable enemy whose avowed objective is world domination. There are no rules in such a game. Hitherto accepted norms of human conduct do not apply. If the United States is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. We must learn to subvert, sabotage, and destroy our enemies by more clever, sophisticated, more effective methods than those used against us. Now, I share that because I think it's very important that one of the most dangerous things to us and to our democracy is the myth that we've all internalized, which is the myth of the benevolent superpower, the myth that we're different, the myth that we're the objective ones on earth and other people aren't objective, the myth that we have a free press and know what's going on and other people don't. All kinds of myths that we've internalized that get in the way of us seeing, recognizing the danger signs, both to other peoples as well as ourselves. So that's part of the background thing I wanted to share. Second thing, part of what we've been blinded to because of that myth is some very obvious, it seems to me, very obvious counter-information that should challenge us. And I'll just give a couple of examples. For example, when we talk about that we support democracy overseas. Guatemala, 1954. Democratic elections, reformist government elected, committed to similar reforms that Nicaragua implemented more recently. What did the U.S. do? It destabilized and overthrew the government of Guatemala. Very, very well documented, even among right and left circles. United Fruit Company lands were going to be expropriated and taken and redistributed. Lots of people united around them. We overthrew a democratically elected government. If we're for democracy, one example. Allende in Chile in the early 70s, another example. Democratically elected socialist government. A country that had a longer history of uninterrupted elections and shifts of power than the United States did. And yet the United States used the military, strengthened the military to overthrow a socialist government that got in the way of the interests of IT&T, Anaconda, Copper, and some other multinationals. Jamaica, under Michael Manley earlier, before Michael Manley learned to live with the U.S. Empire on its border, economically destabilized the Michael Manley regime in Jamaica. Iran, 1953 and 54. Nicaragua from 1979 to 1990, constant intervention in internal affairs. So what I'm trying to give you a picture of is that democracy is a word that the country has used, but it's something that we've never respected. The United States has never respected an election in this hemisphere that went against its perceived interests. You cannot believe in democracy when you don't do that, when you don't respect those differences. Another thing I wanted to suggest at this point, I talked earlier when I dealt with the strategy of low-intensity conflict, I mentioned that it involved integrating military aspects of warfare with economic aspects of warfare, with political diplomatic aspects of warfare, and with psychological aspects of warfare. And I gave examples of all those, and I won't go through that again, but just to remind that to people. Well, one of the major forms of political diplomatic warfare that the United States is using as part of this warfare strategy is the use of elections for undemocratic purposes. The use of elections as a cover for the militarization of societies. I have the figures if anybody wants to see them. But in El Salvador, in Guatemala, and Honduras, particularly El Salvador and Honduras, the U.S. actively worked with the militaries in those countries and said, if we can have elections, political elections, we will guarantee tremendous expansion of your power. But unless you hold them, unless you have the facade of a civilian democracy, you're going to be in trouble. The age of militaries directly controlling, it's not going to happen. We don't want that anymore. It didn't work anymore. So elections, look what happened in El Salvador. The military's power in El Salvador has increased probably 25, 30, 40, 50-fold as a result of this facade of elections. I mentioned to you in the last session about why U.S. bad governments kill priests. I mentioned to you a meeting that took place in 1987 of the, it was called the Conference of American Militaries. And military leaders from the United States and from a dozen or so other countries in Central Latin America gathered. They produced four top secret documents that essentially named the church and liberation theology as dupes of communism and therefore the principal threat to U.S. and other elite economic interests. Well, in the same National Catholic Reporter article that describes this, they quote the military leaders who signed on to these documents as saying that they prefer, quote, a permanent state of military control over civilian government while still preserving formal democracy, end quote. Let me just repeat that. Because the U.S. military leader is a signatory to this document as well. That the military prefers, quote, a permanent state of military control over civilian government while still preserving formal democracy, end quote. And that's the point that I'm trying to make about the incredible danger of this strategy of warfare, that it consciously utilizes elections as a cover for the militarization of societies. And if any of you know who Jose Napoleon Duarte was, Duarte was utilized by the United States at the moment, again, if you followed me earlier, at the moment when the massive terror in El Salvador was being replaced by selective terror. And the death squads were being told, you don't need to kill 100 bodies now every day because people are intimidated. You're counterproductive. Well, Duarte fit in beautifully with this strategy of using elections for undemocratic purposes. Okay, another thing that I wanted to share about the concern about the democracy is just that we are beginning, it seems to me, or well on our way, I'm not sure which, to resembling the national security state that I identified last time. And some of the things that lead me in that direction to think about our own country as a national security state are, that quote I just read would be one certainly, but other things as well. In the Iran-Contra affair, basically, not one thing has changed. Out of the Iran-Contra affair, there has not been one reform, not one reform of the CIA. There has not been one reform of the National Security Council. Keep in mind, in the Iran-Contra affair, what we saw was a fairly sleazy network that involved officials within government and outside of government. Within the CIA, outside of the CIA. A lot of former CIA employees. One of the things that Jimmy Carter did, when Jimmy Carter came in as president, he let go hundreds of CIA officials because he felt that the agency was too top-heavy, and he also let go, unfortunately, and didn't prosecute a lot of people within the CIA who had been known to be involved in illegal gun and drug transactions as part of their CIA activity. He let them go rather than try them, rather than make an issue out of it. Well, what did those people do? They became a kind of second informal CIA that surfaced as being very central actors in this Iran-Contra affair. So having this incredible covert network makes me seriously wonder about how much our formal democracy, particularly in the area of foreign policy, actually means. Another case that's fairly close to home, we have some friends of ours who are Lutheran pastors and workers in churches in Arizona, and they've been working with Salvadoran refugees. It's their church that was infiltrated by the FBI and infiltrated by informers, and then a number of people were carted out of the church and arrested, etc. Well, in their case, the church and some other churches have brought a case against the U.S. government, saying that the government doesn't have the right to infiltrate and spy in churches. Well, I'll try to do this very briefly. It's very complicated. I'm not sure I've got it all straight. But as I understand it, the original court made a decision that said, as churches, you don't have the right to even bring this case. Okay? Then the churches appealed it. And the appeal court said, yes, you do have the right. You can bring this case, but only if you can prove that the government is still spying in churches. If it was just in the past, then you can't. Then you can't bring this case anymore. Well, in response to that, these churches said, okay, well, we're going to start making contacts around the country and try to find out where there's been lots of suspicious activity, which there has been. Try to start compiling it to prove that it's still happening. As they were starting to do that, the government came back and said, we admit it, we're spying in churches. Because they're so confident, their position is, and keep in mind, the spying in these churches, that they didn't have to show probable cause. They didn't have to go before a judge and get permission. They're just spying in churches. Well, the government at this point is so confident of their case that they are saying, we have the right on national security grounds to be spying in churches. Plain and simple. Now, I don't know where it's going to go from there, but that's characteristic of a national security state. The fact that Oliver North, for the most part, all the main figures in the Iran-Contra affair, Richard Secord, all these people got off with little tiny hand slaps. The main reason that they got off is because most of the evidence that is needed to reveal all kinds of things isn't available. And the reason it's not available is under national security grounds. For example, there is a great deal of evidence to suggest that George Bush, through his foreign policy advisor as vice president, Donald Gregg, who's now the ambassador to South Korea, that's his reward, had very shady dealings with a CIA operative, Felix Rodriguez, who was involved in many efforts to assassinate Castro and other CIA efforts in the early 1960s, arranged for the Colombian drug cartel to provide $19 million to the Contras during a time when the U.S. Congress had prohibited any U.S. funding for the Contras. There's a great deal of evidence linking George Bush and other government officials directly to illegal arms shipments to the Contras, and then allowing the planes that brought the arms down from the United States, offloading them or unloading them on the land of a man named John Hull in northern Costa Rica, allowing them to fill up their planes with cocaine and other drugs and fly them into the United States using the same protected flight paths, even entering U.S. air bases where they then weren't checked. Costa Rica has recently done a major study. Costa Rica is a U.S. ally. The U.S. always holds it up as Costa Rica, the one democracy, etc. Well, Costa Rica just did a study of the U.S. using its territory for illegal drug and arms shipments. And based on its study, it is recommending, this government study is recommending to the Costa Rican Congress that Oliver North, John Poindexter, former Ambassador Louis Toms, what's his title? He basically is a CIA representative out of the embassy, but they call him something else. His name is Fernandez. That they and a number of other people be banned for life from ever entering Costa Rica because of their involvement in illegal drug running in the country. And they've concluded, based on their study, that it was Oliver North who went to Panama and met with Noriega and arranged the deal with Noriega that Noriega would support the Contras in exchange for the U.S. closing its eyes to Noriega's drug running. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on about all this stuff. But we get none of that. And the reason we get none of it, or very little of it, makes me think, are we living in a national security state? Because the reason we don't get it is they say, no, we can't reveal that because that would reveal national security secrets.
Two questions. One is, what's happening to the Christic Institute case on this whole thing? And weren't they also attacked? I can't remember, there was some plea from Christic Institute. Maybe you could talk about that. And the second thing is, it appears that the Philippines, something fishy went on there, and I haven't figured it out.
Okay. It's fine that we move into questions. Let me say two other things, and then I'll come to the questions. And you've already mentioned, directly or indirectly, both of them. The media, for me, and I do a whole section in this book on the media. If we live in a country with a free press, why are we so ignorant? That's the question that I ask myself. And so the media, which is a large business, also plays a role in this. And the other thing for me about the economy, and there's a good article in the most recent Sojourners article, or Sojourners magazine, by Gar Alpovitz, I think his name is, who's a long-time alternative economist, who's basically saying that our democracy is in trouble because of the concentration of economic power. So that's a whole nother level of thinking about democracy. Okay, your two questions briefly. The Christic Institute lawsuit, as I understand it, the Christic Institute is a public interest law firm that has brought a suit against many of the key actors in the Iran-Contra affair and lays out in a lot of gory detail long-term relationships between many of these CIA, former CIA, present CIA, high-level government officials in a lot of the stuff that I've just been talking about. Their suit was thrown out by a judge in Florida, I think, and they have appealed it, and the appeal process is still underway. And my understanding, the last I heard, which was about 5 months ago, was they expected sometime this summer for that case, for the court to rule on bringing it back in. If you want to know, do I think it's going to go very far in the court, I don't think it will. But it's an important vehicle for raising a lot of these issues, which I think we have to raise. The Philippines, I just talked to some people who have lived in the Philippines for a long time, and much of the strategy that I've laid out here that has been implemented in Central America is being work done in the Philippines. Aquino, in many ways, is a similar kind of figure as Duarte, for example. Aquino, Marcos became a liability because Marcos became a destabilizing influence. His corruption became destabilizing. Aquino comes in, promises reform, has a lot of popular support because, get rid of Marcos, but there's nothing fundamental that's changed in the Philippines, economically, etc. My understanding from observers who are fairly close to the situation is they say the United States is pursuing a two-track policy with the Philippines that's related to the bases. The U.S. wants to keep the bases there. One is, it's working with Aquino and saying, you've got to convince your senators that they've got to ratify this treaty that will let us keep the bases, because right now, they don't have the votes. The majority of the senators are not going to go for it. The second track that they're on is that the U.S., on the one hand, working with Aquino to do that, is helping orchestrate the coups against her. It's called a two-track policy because you cover your bases either way. So much of this stuff is happening as well in the Philippines. Also, some of the people who were involved in the Iran-Contra affair, like General Singlob, I have some great quotes from General Singlob in this book in which he says, we've got enough material out here stockpiled that we can bypass the U.S. Congress for years, in terms of carrying out. And he's you know who he was talking to? It was a memo to William Casey. the CIA director. But anyway, Singlob, who's in at right in the center of a lot of this Iran Contra stuff, all of a sudden was making major appearances in the Philippines. And part of the speculation was, and this was at a time when, I forget what they're called now, but it's essentially, it's the equivalent of El Salvador's death squads have grown dramatically in the Philippines in the last 3 or 4 years. And a lot of people trace that to some of the activities of people like Singlob. Why don't we just, let's just open it up for questions, yeah, and conversation.
I think I've been overwhelmed by information. Could you briefly redefine the national security state?
Yeah, let me see if I can find what I said. I wrote down. I didn't talk specifically about the national security state, no. But in yesterday, in just preparing the notes, I just tried to throw a few things down, and I'll just repeat those briefly. And this was, I was thinking about this specifically in relation to Central and Latin American governments. So this, I might think a little differently as I were to name it for our own. But one element is that you view the world as a grand struggle between international communism and capitalism. And in the form of Latin America, oftentimes that takes a more of a form of state capitalism, and ours is a little bit different. But second, that you view the capital accumulation of elites. You view the wealthiest sector in your society as the key to development and freedom. But that inequality, in a way, has to be preserved because they're the ones who can be the locomotives of development. It's through their investment, it's through their power that society has the hope to evolve. A third is that enemies of freedom are lurking everywhere, and the internal, external, and that they need to be combated. And fourth is that the military is the ultimate guardian of that national security state. And the military almost becomes the noble defender against all these subversive elements. Now, if I were to add one word, and I think any of you who have listened to Oliver North's speeches and others would catch on to this. The thing that frightens me most about the national security state, and this has been my experience when I've spoken to military people, is their response to me, and I've said this maybe in other settings, but their response to me is not to question what I laid out in this book. Their response is, you don't know the kind of world we live in. You don't know the kind of world we live in. And we do what we do because we have to do it in order to protect X. I mean, so the ultimate value of the national security state, or what binds it together, is this belief of real service in spite of the people. In spite of the people. When I spoke to some military people in Honduras recently, and U.S. Embassy officials in Honduras, they made constant jokes about Congress, about the ineptitude of Congress to understand anything about what was going on in Central America. That it was their duty to carry it out. Now, taken to the extreme, what that led to, and I haven't even mentioned this yet, is that during the height of a number of years ago, during the height of the internal debates and conflict over U.S. policy in Central America, Oliver North and the National Security Council developed plans for detention centers. I think it was 10 or 12 detention centers to house 400,000 political prisoners in this country, to declare a state of national emergency in the case of an actual outright U.S. military intervention in Central America. And the original idea was that mainly who would be rounded up were illegal aliens from the Central American countries themselves. But you don't have to go too far in your imagination to think that it's probably good that I speak Spanish. 400, and that plan was practiced. I mean, it was implemented and practiced. So that's a little background into the national security state.
I want to just make sure. sure there's time for us to get to the question we didn't get to yesterday, for everybody to hear everybody's ideas on what can we do.
Okay.
I want to make sure that...
We better start now.
Yeah.
And that was going to be my next question.
Because you're leaving today, too. So
right. I want to go out there with a little bit of
feeling. What I want to try to think about is...
Some power.
Is an example of South Africa. I don't know how much you know about that, but something did happen in this country where maybe it's still consistent with the low-intensity conflict in that the Afrikaners, the National Party, became a liability. And so the United States, you know, finally saw which way the wind was blowing, and maybe that's the explanation, so we can't use it as a parallel. But I guess the question, since our talk last night, the question I'm thinking about is how do we get the apartheid, what can we learn from the anti-apartheid movement in terms of how we woke up the United States people to have a consistent pressure to have, and particularly the Congress, to do the kind of things there that they ought to be doing in relation to Central America. Do you have any senses? Have you talked to anybody about what the parallels might be?
Well, I think you had consistent leadership in Congress from the Black Caucus, for one. I mean, that would be one lesson, is that we've got to encourage and develop and elect better people who are going to persistently pursue this. And in the case, it's an unusual situation where you have the Black Caucus, and particularly in Congress, taking major leadership on this for a long period of time.
Right.
You also had within South Africa a situation that just couldn't be ignored, and that's after, you know, 25, 30 years of struggle. But the discussion we had, that some of us were at last night, about Kairos. We didn't talk last night about the impact of the Kairos document and the awakening of the churches and saying it's a sin to support apartheid. I mean, that wasn't in itself a thing, but it was linked up with the broader struggle in South Africa, became a tremendous force both internationally. Plus, apartheid has a visibility.
Right.
And a despicability.
It's not low intensity. That's
right. It's not as low intensity. It's highly visible. It's harder to.
Yeah.
So I think there are limited parallels. But I think the lessons that we can learn, maybe just getting to the question of what does this mean? I don't have great answers to that question, but the way that I try to answer it is I try to answer the question in terms of that it involves our responding in all areas of our lives. And so for me, all of us have some control over things like, do we pay taxes? If so, how many? How much? How do we use our time? Lifestyle choices of you know, are we using all of our time to try to create a nice, secure environment for our family? Or are we making choices whereby we live at a more sufficiency level and therefore can use our work time for political organizing and use our work time in other kinds of ways? It means, for me, involvement in some ways with the money and resources that we have, and funneling that money rather than into consumerism, supporting social change groups, supporting groups like Witness for Peace or Pastors for Peace, or development organizations like Oxfam, or I know Joe, who's been doing the environmental stuff, it encourages involvement in I2 with groups like Bread for the World, who are working in that arena. And it involves, I think, more pressure on Congress than simply writing a letter. I mean, the one limited success story that we have in Minnesota in terms of public policy change was Senator Durenberger, who was a Contra supporter on the inside of power. He was the head of the Senate Intelligence Oversight Committee. And he was a Contra supporter. And the community that I'm a part of, and some others, basically for 3 years in a row, had meetings in his office once a week for 3 years. And Dan Spencer was a part of one of the most creative. You turned it into a bloodmobile or something, right? Or a blood-giving thing, because he was spilling blood by supporting the Contras, and people went there and gave blood. They got all kinds of publicity. Anyway, Durenberger, who I still don't like his politics very well, became an opponent of the U.S. war. That would not have happened if I would have just written a letter to Durenberger. So some kind of persistent pressure in the political realm. And then the last thing I would say that's important to me is I think, particularly as people of faith, as Christian and Jewish and other people of faith, we need to somehow creatively withdraw from the dominant culture. And we've got to find, I mean, Holden is kind of an example where we come and do that for a few weeks or for a few months, where you're in a community where money isn't the main thing and where you use your time and creative enterprises with the community. I think we need to think of ways of doing that on neighborhood levels and that's part of what I devote my time to too. So, I mean, there's no blueprint for how we bring about changes in this country. But certainly taking the scales off of our eyes and then seeing that what we face are very big obstacles, and we've got to somehow order our lives around it more than simply respond in our spare time. Those are some of the crucial things, I think. Anybody want to add to that, other ideas? I know we got like 1 minute here.
Would you just repeat that last, as people of faith that need somehow creatively withdraw
from the dominant culture and dominant society and create alternatives that, see, I think our culture is an enormously alienating one. In the midst of all of our wealth and all of our poverty, there's a common thread of alienation. And part of what we need to do in alternative communities is to demonstrate that by living with more integrity out our faith, we can do that in a joyful, life-giving way, because then that invites people in.
I would add, in sort of the education process, or just as we go through our lives, to confront people. I decided a couple years ago, I'm not going to listen to any more racist jokes without saying something to say, I'm uncomfortable with that. And I think the same thing goes here. If I hear something that doesn't resonate with me, I gotta speak up. And it's going to be uncomfortable sometimes. I'm going to feel isolated, but I think it needs to be done.
That's very important, very important. Let me just close this for now, and again, we'll have one more, those of you who are around at least and want to come, we'll have one more session in which we can talk. I want us to talk some about hope and different action things the next time too. But the topic that we had last night that a few of us came to about this Kairos thing, this sense of moment of truth in which the churches and other faith communities are being confronted with a really an opportunity as well as a crisis, I think is really important for us to think about the significance of that. Because I believe that unless we have an awakening, and probably it's probably not going to be the institutional church, it's probably not going to be the hierarchy, it's probably not going to be the whole church that I'm a part of, Holy Trinity Lutheran, but it's going to be small groups of people within churches that remain connected that really serve to take off these scales and start living differently. I think Dan has talked quite a bit about this in his session, that somehow we are being called to new ways of being faithful. And I think as we explore that with others, that offers a lot of hope for finding ways of living creatively in light of some of the issues that I've been talking about. Okay, well, we had promised not to go over, and we're a couple minutes over, so thank you. Thank you. Thank you.